You're listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense with your host, Doug Thorpe. Here's Doug.
Hello again, everyone. This is Doug Thorpe, and you're listening to another episode of Leadership Powered by Common Sense. Today, we're going to turn our attention to the idea of exiting a business. And there is much that's been written about the so-called silver tsunami that is in play right now. Some $6 to $7 trillion of small business wealth is being transferred generationally by baby boomers who are ready to cash out and move on with the other new chapter in their life. And when you think about that kind of transaction, there's a whole lot of consideration. So I have had the privilege of meeting a gentleman who is well-versed in all aspects of that, and he's agreed to come on this show today. His name is Wayne Zell. Wayne, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me on your show today.
You bet. And Wayne is I guess if he was in sports, he would be called a double threat or triple threat. He, and I may not get this perfectly right, and you correct me, Wayne. He is a licensed attorney. He's also a CPA, and his firm, Zell Law, and there's another firm associated with it, I think, and I'll let you describe that. But anyway, they are doing a lot of work helping people prepare for that exit event. So, Wayne, talk to us a little bit about your landscape and all the buttons you push on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing this for a long time. I've been practicing as an attorney for almost 40 years now and as a CPA for about 44, actually. And the thing that I've learned over time is that being grounded in tax law is a really beneficial and helpful tool that helps me both on advising people on their estate planning as well as on their income tax planning and their corporate stuff. So I do, my practice is sort of split between doing estate work and for entrepreneurs mostly, and then also representing companies that are growing and planning to exit. So I'm also part of the Business Enterprise Institute, which specializes in exit planning. And there's no better time to be focusing on that than now with the silver tsunami, as you characterized it, going on. So our firm does pieces of both on the law side. And then I have a firm called Aspire to Exit, which really is serving entrepreneurs and helping prepare for and execute the exit from their business. Sometimes it's legal, so that'll be shifted over to the Zell Law side. Other times we'll bring in outside lawyers, outside consultants, valuation experts, investment bankers, human resource people, you name it, to help with the transition and growth of the business so that they can exit profitably and get their transferable value out of their business.
Well, I want to start with a very fundamental question or discussion. It's my humble perception that a lot of small business owners, when they go into the game and they get the opportunity or idea to create their business, they categorically don't get a lot of legal or tax advice on structure. So they use kind of an off-the-shelf, file an LLC, you can get your EIN for free from the IRS, and you're off to the races. You feel like, oh, good, I'm legal and I got my business. Well, what's wrong with that approach?
Well, I don't know if there's anything wrong with the approach because it gets you started and you don't have to be held up by lawyers and CPAs and others. But the real question is, what is the proper choice of entity for your business going forward? So while you may think an LLC is the only way you should go, and it is predominantly the way most people go, particularly in service businesses, there are other alternatives that you have to think about. For example, if you're building a product like a software product or a SaaS product that you want to take out to the marketplace, and you ultimately can grow this product and be very successful with it over time. You're actually better off thinking about setting up your business as a C corporation. And you can be an LLC and be a C corporation. You can be an LLC and be an S corporation. You could be an LLC and be a partnership or a disregarded entity. So LLCs are very flexible. And so I don't have any problem in starting off that way. But the real question is, if you want to take advantage of, say, the exclusion for qualified small business stock under code section 1202, which everybody goes, huh, what are you talking about? You can exclude up to $10 million or 10 times your adjusted basis in the stock of capital gains on the sale of the stock. So only C corporations can do this. By contrast, certain service businesses like lawyers, doctors, engineers, architects, consultants, broker dealers, financial advisors cannot take advantage of that. So should I set it up as an LLC taxed as a partnership if I've got one other owner with me, or should I use an S corp? And again, there are benefits and detriments of using these structures. So unless you know the tax side of things, and you can sort of project down the line as to what you're going to be doing 5-10 years down the road, then you need to be very careful. And you really should consult with an expert in tax off the bat. And now one more caveat. If you talk only to your CPA, they're going to be looking at the short run and the short run income tax consequences to you of whatever structure you select. Whereas I'm looking at not only that, but I'm looking down the road at what happens if you sell the company, what's going to be the impact to you. So S corps, while they're very favorable and useful for a lot of companies that are starting up, there's also some downsides down the road. So you have to be aware of all those downsides, and then you make a decision. And we usually drive the client towards the right structure at the very beginning. And I think people are really appreciative of that. It might cost a little bit extra to do that, but it's definitely worth it.
Right. Well, the irony in all that is you work many years to grow your business and get it up to a certain level of success, then you do decide either it's a lifestyle choice, because of your journey in life, you're ready to exit, or you get approached and somebody says, I really like your business, I want to make you an offer and roll it into my enterprise. And the point that I take away, and our show's called Common Sense, and it's just a real simplistic view, but my view is, why work hard 10, 12, 15 years and you lose half of the value to the tax man?
I'm with you, pal. Doug, I agree with you 100%. Because I'm a tax guy from the very beginning, back in 1980, I'm really focused on making sure that the client understands what the net after tax effect is of whatever they're going to do on an exit. And so another example, never put real estate into a corporation, ever. So I have all these older clients coming to me who've done that 50 years ago, and they say, well, I've got a $5 million piece of real estate, it's commercial real estate, in my C corporation. And I go, who did that? Who set that thing up? But, you know, again, it's history sometimes cannot be overcome, and other times it can be. There are ways of trying to restructure things down the road, but I think it's better to be a little wise up front in your planning. And planning for the exit, by the way, starts at the beginning. I mean, you cannot, like Stephen Covey said, you know, any planning that starts at the beginning. You need to think about the exit at the beginning. Now, if you're too busy building your business, growing your business, working in your business, I get it. But you need to step back periodically, at least once a year, and think about, what am I doing to work on the business? And by the way, what is my exit plan for this business? And what happens if something unexpected happens, which most people don't want to think about? They don't want to think about how they need to have some type of estate planning structure that melds with their business plan. And most estate planners don't know how to do that, believe it or not. So as a business planning lawyer and an estate planning lawyer, I've put together sort of the package that every client, every business owner really needs to think about to make sure that they're protected for the unexpected events as well as for their expected exit, whatever that may be.
Yeah, that's a great point, because the unexpected is just that. We don't plan for it per se. You don't know what the event is going to be, but sad are the many stories where it did in fact happen, and there's an entanglement that ensues, and usually the business is the suffering entity from that. But
absolutely.
Well, on that note, and it's a bad segue here, but let's talk a little bit about the generational handoff idea. I've had several guests on my show of late who have been the recipients of a business that they bought from a parent. And while the stories are inevitably complex, I haven't had one yet that was just a real straight shot that they hoped it would be. There were turns and detours. Any thoughts about general framing and approach to the notion of an outright transfer or sale of the business to next generation?
Well, as you probably know, and as many of the listeners probably know, it's really difficult to transition a business from G1, generation one, to G2, and even further, more difficult to do it to G3 or G4. I have a lot of clients who are fourth and fifth generation businesses, and that's a miracle in and of itself. The statistic is something like less than 20% or between 20-25% of all businesses that are family-owned businesses successfully transfer to the next generation from G1 to G2, and less than half of them, it turns out to be less than 12%, go to the third generation and beyond. And the reason is primarily because the founder may be a charismatic leader, maybe somebody who has created the value in the business and the vision in the business and drives the business from day one. And it's very difficult to get them to stay away from the business, even in their 70s and 80s. I mean, they really want to stay involved, even though it's probably important for them to consider transferring it to the next generation, either of family members or managers, people who are working with them. So there are different ways of doing that. But I find that it's really one of the most difficult transition projects is working in family-owned businesses. I've got several going on right now where G1 is trying to transfer the business to G2. And the first thing that G1 needs to think about, the older generation, is at some point I need to step away from the business, and I need to establish that date and set it in stone. Now, it doesn't always work out that way. I'll give you a quick example, quick story. I had a client who was the youngest son of a guy that had founded this business out of Massachusetts that was very successful. They manufactured pool supplies and pool toys and things like that. Very successful, very profitable business. And the owner had basically created a generational plan to transfer it to his sons. The youngest son wasn't involved in the business because he was much younger than his two older brothers. So he kind of got excluded from that, and he was a little bitter about that. But at one point, the founder was in his 80s, and he basically realized that the business was not being managed properly by his sons. And so he, at the age of 83, he had to step back into the business and resurrect what was once a very profitable business that was turned into an unprofitable one. So there are not only challenges with the founder stepping away, but there are challenges with the competency of the next generation of family, and then who really should be running the business. So if you have multiple family members involved in the business, then the question is, well, who's going to run it, and what's the role of the other family members? And what happens if you've got a family member that's in the business and others who are not? What happens if you have none of the family members in the business? So there is no simple algorithm or simple algebraic formula that I can use, particularly on family-owned businesses, that'll tell you this is how you should do it. I wrote a book called Your Multi-Million Dollar Exit, which I think you may have alluded to earlier, but In that book, we talk about the challenges of family-owned businesses and how you transfer them. And sometimes it may be by sale, sometimes it may be by gift, sometimes it may be by partial gift and partial sale, sometimes it may be by a bargain sale at the lowest, you know, feasible value that an appraiser is willing to value the business at. And the question is, what does the founder need out of the business? How much mm-hmm. money do they need to continue to receive out of the business? That's one of the first things you have to check into when you're doing your business exit planning. So has the founder planned for himself or herself after retiring from the business? And what were they getting from the business? And what do they need to continue getting from the business? And then is it affordable to sell it to the next generation? Can the next generation afford to pay the founder what they need to get out of the business? So all of these are, it's a very, very calculated and very, very detailed analysis that you have to go through. And I can tell you that there is no cookie cutter approach to this at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a guest on my show a few months ago. She was the G2 in a situation. The company had been founded and created by her dad and had rocked along for many years. And, you know, she came up, grew up, went to school, went off kind of doing her own thing. And then the dad said, you seem to have developed a pretty good general business, general operation mindset. I think I need help. Could you come join us? And she said, yeah, sure, I'll do that. So she went to work for the company for a season and apparently did miraculous things and changed employee morale and a whole bunch of other things. And then she said, I think my work here is done. Can I, you know, go on with what else I want to do? Because the dad had no indication of wanting to sell. Mm-hmm. And she left, and within weeks, the staff had created a petition and said, if she doesn't come back and you leave, we're all out. And sure. It was a handwritten notepad sheet.
Signed by all the employees.
And all the employees presented it to the G1 owner. And fortunately, as I understand this story, he was emotionally intelligent enough to take that with good intention and called her and said, I want to show you something. And she came over and he showed her this letter. And lo and behold, at the bottom of the long list of employees, he and his wife signed it and gave it to her.
Yeah, but sometimes it doesn't always work out that way. I mean, sometimes
the
daughter or the son or whoever it is doesn't always want to be involved in the business because they have other goals and objectives in their lives. And that
right.
I've seen right. that too. So there are a series of meetings that, particularly with family-owned businesses, that you want to have. You want to have meet with the founder and their spouse. Then, you know, after you've sort of figured out what their objectives are or not, you want to meet with the children, those who are involved in the business and those who may not be involved in the business and what their expectations and hopes and wishes are. And then you also want to meet with the management of the business if there are other people involved in the business other than just the family. And oftentimes that is the case. In real small businesses that are family run, no, that's not often the case. But in larger enterprises, there may be other managers involved, operations, finance, HR, whatever it is. And you've got to understand what their thinking is as well. And you build that into a plan, but only after you've started having these meetings. And then you get everybody together and start articulating what the goals and objectives are, provided that there are no time bombs ticking in the messages that were received in those private meetings. But you usually have to start out with these private meetings. And oftentimes we'll bring in a family governance expert. I do a lot of that myself, but I'll bring in somebody who's a psychologist, who's an expert in family governance. And I have connections around with people around the country that do that. And I think it's really helpful to have somebody come in and sort of mediate and facilitate the transition with the family.
Well, I forget where I first learned it, but there was a principle that I have found very valuable, and I've shared it with clients, and that is when you do have family associated with, and it doesn't have to be direct lineage. It could be in-laws, outlaws, cousins, nephews, etc. It's important to draw some circles and define the roles that they play.
Yes.
You know, and one role, one of the possible circles is I'm just a family member. You know, I don't have anything to do with the business. I'm going to move into that square, and that's the only thing I'm going to do. Others have to do with being an employee of the business, not an owner, but an employee or investor. They might have a financial stake in the business, but you know, you got to be careful what that looks like.
I've got a great story for you that hits on all those points. It's in the intro in my book, but I had a guy that had come to me for estate planning and exit planning, business exit planning. And so we were just starting the process, and I got a call from his son, who had previously dated my daughter. I got a call from his son right before New Year's, and he alerted me. He said, "Mr. Zell, I want to let you know my dad just died." I said, "What?" "He's 55 years old. What happened?" He said he went into diabetic shock, and he fell and he hit his head and died from the blow. I said, "I'm really sorry." And we helped him, you know, sort of transition towards, you know, what to do next. But I said, after the funeral, let's get together and figure out what's going on. So we got together after the funeral, and it turns out that he had minority investors in his business that he was smart enough to bring in, actually, in this particular case, because he was a government contractor and he needed some people with gray hair and experience that had done this and been there before. And he brought in one guy that was fabulous. He's long since passed, but this guy was one of the founders of SAIC, which is one of the largest government contractors in the world. And he was an investor in his business, and he brought in two other minority investors who had transitioned from a service disabled business and sold their company and made a lot of money doing it. So he had these three investors. His son was also an employee of the company, and his wife had no involvement in the company whatsoever, but this guy had not done any estate planning. And so everything had to go through probate, which is unfortunate, but the bottom line is the ultimate, you know, beneficiary of all of this under his will, which he did have, was his wife, who had no involvement in the business. So what we did was we built a board of directors. Board of directors consisted of the investors, consisted of me as an advisor, consisted of the son, who was involved in the company and who knew about the company on a day-to-day basis, and the wife, who really had no involvement in the company, but had a beneficial stake. She had an interest in this business. And the board, we were able to first fire the CFO, who we found was stealing from the business, number one. Number two, we brought in a management team that helped us run the business, and they tripled the revenue in the 3 years after the founder had passed unexpectedly. And then I helped bring in the investment bankers, where we hired an investment banking firm that helped us sell the company for $30 million, and the family was set. So fortunately, he had these investors already involved, people who had real deep experience, but it doesn't always work out that way. And building a board of directors is one of the key components that most people don't even think about. They think, "Oh, I'm the owner of the company. I am the board of directors." Well, it might be good to at least have a board of advisors, if not a board of directors, to help guide you along. And I've seen companies that had boards with vested board members who were interested in the success of the business, they usually succeed, particularly if the business model is good and it's being operated well. So that's just a little story on investors, family, employees, all coming together to figure out what to do next for the business and exit successfully from it.
Fabulous story, and so true of the work that can be done. And I'm with you on the notion of some kind of outside board, either advisors or directors. And I can think of several entrepreneurs that I know who have gone that route, and whether those people sitting around the table are minority investors in the business, or whether they are just experts in the field and know something about the industry and can provide wisdom and guidance. I'm with you. Inevitably, when that is present, the company is far more successful than just what the founder is going
to
be doing.
These people, you got to incentivize them to have some skin in the game, if you will, and really help you focus. But it's not just about incentivizing them. It's about people who really can help you grow your business. Who's going to serve on your board? Is it somebody who has industry knowledge? Yeah, I think that's a really good choice. Is it somebody who's exited a business in your industry previously? Another good choice. Is it somebody with financial background, financial acumen, accounting background? Very good choice. Is it somebody that is part of the family unit? Yeah, I think they need to be involved in the decision making. You may not want to give them veto power, but they should be involved because they're the ones who are the people that benefit from all this. They're the beneficial owners of all of this. So I think it's a good idea to have a diverse and well-heeled board to help guide you through that process while you're competent. Before something happens to you, but it's always good to have that management succession plan, as we call it, in the event of an unexpected exit as well.
Right. Well, back real quick to the family-related involvement. As you know, Wayne, I'm involved with a national company that is doing a lot in the service industry, the home service business specific. We're helping individuals who want to be entrepreneurs by acquisition find businesses, buy those businesses, and then transition through the businesses. And there are a number of case situations that we've been through where the seller owner has employed an extended family member. Maybe it's a brother, maybe it's a nephew, maybe it's, you know, something, some member of the family tree. And the new owner moves in only to discover that's not the strongest person on the team. You know, there's in fact quite the contrary. So there's that awkward moment of having to, as a new owner, deal with that reality and right size the team for the work they want to do. And it can be a little awkward. And I've come to the mindset of when I learn from a buyer that there might be existing in the business, I try to turn their attention as much as possible pre-close to the discussion about, can you help me with this? Is there anything to the seller, you know, can you smooth this pathway? Because I'm not seeing this in my master plan.
I was just going to ask you about that. I think the way I would approach it is the buyer in his or her due diligence needs to make sure that they know everything about the business before they get in and buy it. And if they don't discover the fact that there's this errant family member that's lurking in the background that's getting paid $150,000, $200,000 a year to do nothing, and then they inherit the business, that's not a good fact pattern. The best fact pattern is first find out all the key employees, who's there, what do they do, what transferable value is there if the founder doesn't stay with the business, and then, you know, are there any of these people that aren't really transferable as part of the business, and how do you handle that? It needs to be an open, transparent discussion, and that has to be done prior to closing. So if that person is not going to be one that's going to continue with the business, that needs to be articulated to the seller. The seller may not be happy about it, but the seller is the one who created the problem, and that potentially devalues the business or enhances the value if we can get rid of that person and increase the earnings of the business. But, it's all part of due diligence. It's all part of the pre-sale investigation and preparation.
Totally agree. And that's exactly what we've done in our approach to these things as we're coaching these acquisition entrepreneurs through the process. We lean heavy in that due diligence step to, and that goes well beyond the personnel, but personnel is certainly a key factor. And it's not uncommon that the sellers are unwilling to divulge everything about the team. And we call that a red flag. It's like, then you may think twice about pursuing this.
I agree with that. I think
we say to the buyer,
the seller needs to be transparent completely. If the seller's not willing to be, or there's something that they're hiding, they're not being represented competently by counsel either, because that could lead to other claims of fraud or misrepresentation. And you just don't want to go there. I mean, it's the last thing on earth that you want to be dealing with, large acquisitions or small acquisitions. It's not something you just don't want to hide anything. You want to open up the kimono. I'll give you another example. I had a guy that had a roofing company. He called me up to represent him in the sale. I wasn't his counsel normally. And so I said, sure, I'll come in and we'll start doing some due diligence on you. And we did, and we had a great buyer. Everything was moving along really smoothly. And then about 3 weeks before the closing was scheduled, I get a call from the seller, and he says, I forgot to tell you one thing. I said, what'd you forget to tell me? He said, I had this side deal with one of my guys down in Norfolk, Virginia, to, give him a piece of the company. I said, it's not anywhere in your corporate records. You don't have any, there's no stock that's been issued to him. What did you promise him? He said, well, we had a sort of a back of the envelope, literally, deal where I gave him 3% of the business. I said, unless you want to give him 3% of the business when you sell, you need to work this out now. And then we can go back to the buyer and say, we had this issue, which we have to disclose, but we've solved it. So we did. We solved it. We got his regular counsel that had helped him with, general litigation and other stuff over the years. And they worked out a settlement agreement with this guy, and he got paid something. And the other guy was disclosed what was happening so that he wouldn't have some kind of lawsuit against the seller. And it all worked out. But you got to be really careful, because you never know who's lurking in the background. And therefore, be transparent if you're a seller. And if you're a buyer, look out for sellers who are not being transparent. So you're on the buy side, Doug, helping these clients get ready for an acquisition. If I'm a buyer, I would walk away unless I have all the details I need to be absolutely comfortable, or reduce the purchase price down to next to nothing and pay them out if everything works out after the acquisition. So it would be structured as an earnout. So there are different ways of doing it, but the seller needs to be transparent is the bottom line.
Totally. And you're right. And that transparency by the seller is so vital. And the good news is we've had plenty of sellers that are very transparent, very forthcoming, because I think they're generally honest business people. They truly believe they have absolutely nothing to hide, and they're proud of what they've accomplished. So they want to show it all to you. Let me explain how we dealt with that. Let me show you what we did over here. And those are wonderful transactions to find. We had one that closed.
Not all of them are wonderful, but I think I've done over 160 transactions over my career, and it rises by 3 or 4 a year on average. Of that number, probably 90% are sell side transactions, mostly, smaller companies selling to bigger buyers, private equity buyers, strategic buyers, et cetera, family buyers, management buyers. But the idea is that I know a lot about what the buyers are looking for, because I've dealt with pretty much every law firm in the country on this stuff. And I also have dealt with, on the buy side, what things you need to be cautious about. But the seller needs education. And that's the biggest thing. Most of these people have never sold a business before. They've had their business their career, or they built it up from scratch, and they need education. So what we try to do is really educate them on the pitfalls, the ins and outs. My book gets into a lot of that. If you haven't read it, take a look at it, because it does get into a lot of discussion about things that the seller needs to be aware of, that the buyer's thinking or the buyer's counsel's thinking, but they're not going to tell you necessarily at the front end because they're not going to just be as transparent with you as they want you to be with them. So it's not a game, and it's not nefarious. It's just the way business is conducted. You've got to know what the ins and outs are so that you can be prepared for it.
Yeah. So Wayne, tell us the name of the book again.
Yeah, here it is. It's Your Multi-Million Dollar Exit, and it's available on Amazon. It's also, we can sell it in bulk over my website, waynezell.com. It's my author's website. But it's available on Amazon in paperback, hardback, Audible. I narrated the book. That was an interesting experience, and it was a lot of fun. And it's available on Kindle as well.
That's great. Well, on that note, as always, folks, we're going to have those links and references in the show notes. So don't forget to hop down and click on any of those links if you are interested. It's a great book, by the way. There's a lot of information in it. And I'll be honest, when Wayne shared a copy with me, I cracked the spine and started reading through it, and I thought, I'm back in graduate school.
But I didn't want it to be that way. I don't want it to be, I want it to be consumable so that the entrepreneur can read it. So one of the best pieces of advice another author gave me, a friend of mine, he said, look, you got an executive summary in this book. It's 23 pages. It's not very long. It sort of lays out all the key points in each chapter. He said, put it in the front of the book. So if the entrepreneur wants to just read about, you know, the executive summary and they don't want to read the whole thing, they can read the executive summary for some really good points. And then if they don't understand it or they want to learn more about it, then you deep dive into the book, and even deeper dives are available for really technical discussions. So yeah. And there are examples through the book, and it's a good effort on my part. It took me a long time to write it.
That's what I was going to say. Just as I often do on books of this kind, I immediately go to the table of contents and I look at what might be there. And that's when I said, oh God, I'm going back to graduate school. But then, to your point, I really started leaning in and was curious and read. And it's a great read, folks. I got to tell you, if this is where you are in your business journey, that you might be ready to do an exit, or more importantly, and this is the one thing I want everybody to take away, if you're running a business, I don't care how old your business is, if you've not yet considered the end game and the exit you might have one way or another, now's the time to start shaping that, designing that plan, and putting that blueprint together on what you might consider, because it just may drive the future value of your business. And you know, Wayne, it's hit me here. We've had a great discussion, but that's one big area we haven't talked about, and that is that moment where an owner thinks he wants to sell the business, but gets somebody to come in and kind of do an initial valuation, and you say to yourself, oh, I think my business is ought to sell for about $7 million. And the valuator says, no, it's more like $3 million. And you go, oh my God, what's wrong? And then if the advisor person is helpful, they're going to give you some hotspot areas to consider. That.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things we work on as part of the exit planning process. But the idea is get a valuation today on what the business is worth, not what you think it'll be worth in 5 years. What's it worth today? And then what do you think it's worth? And what do you need from the business? And so if you've gone through that analysis, you can figure out what the value gap is in terms of dollars. And then you also need somebody to help point out the value gaps in terms of capabilities in the business. So if for example, you're the founder and you're doing all the financial stuff, the accounting and the finance and all that type of stuff, that's not a good recipe for transferring a business unless the buyer has that capability. Most buyers that are significant will have the ability to bring in their own financial people, controllers, et cetera. And so they don't need you to worry about that. But if you're the founder out there bringing in all the business, making all the rain, and there's nobody else after you that is capable of doing that, that seriously affects the valuation of the business and what we call transferable value. Is there value to be transferred if you're not associated with the business? So one of the things that may happen is the buyer may say, well, I'm okay buying the business, but I'm going to pay you less up front and I'm going to pay you over a period of 3 years or so to stay with the business and ensure all the clients are transferred and you help us, you know, transfer all the intellectual capital in your brain so that we can run this business after you're gone. So those are all the things that that go into the valuation process and how to value a business. We talk about that in the book too, but I think the idea is get a valuation. If you've been in business for more than a year, get a valuation. Find out what the business is worth today. It involves historical information, but it also involves your projections and are they reasonable projections and who's part of your management team, which is also a very important factor in transitioning a business to a buyer. You got to have people who can run the business if you're not there. If you don't have it, that's going to make it really tough to transfer the business for any significant value, regardless right. of what you've heard from your buddies down the street or,
right.
or others who've transferred the business,
yeah.
their business. So
yeah. Very important consideration, folks. Well, with that, Wayne, I think we're about up on time today. Thank you so much for sitting in and sharing with us. It's been a real pleasure.
Doug, thank you so much for having me on your show. And again, I appreciate you being on my show. And we'll hopefully connect again soon on these topics.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, folks, with that, we're going to wrap this up. I do like to remind you, we've got a video version of this over on YouTube, channel by the same name, Leadership Powered by Common Sense. Hop over there, check out the archive. You can look up the references I've made to prior guests and things and hear their story in more detail. But again, all the reference points, the link to the book and Wayne's firm, all those links will be in our show notes. So I'll hop down there, take a look and check it out. So with that, we're going to say goodbye. Go out there, make it a great day.
You've been listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense, hosted by Doug Thorpe. If you would like to know more about the coaching and advisory services he provides, visit DougThorpe.com.